Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the new episode of the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology, organized by the European Academy of Neurology. Let me introduce myself. I'm Francesco Di Lorenzo, a neurologist working on dementia in Santa Lucia Foundation in Rome. And I'm part of the management group of the scientific panel of dementia. And today we will speak about the management of behavior and psychiatric symptoms in dementia. Our guest is one of the biggest experts on this topic, and is Professor Doug Harsland. Just a very quick notes on Professor biography. He's got the chair of old age psychiatry at the King's College London, and he dedicated most of his studies on the behavioral symptoms, especially of neurodegenerative diseases. So I thank Professor Harsland for accepting our invitation. So I want to start first with a comment about the importance of a timely diagnosis and the proper therapeutic management of the behavioral symptoms in dementia, especially talking about the socio-economical burden of these symptoms for patients and also for their families.
Yes, thank you, Francesco, and thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure, and I'm very pleased that EAN is also interested and sees the importance of these common symptoms of dementia and also very problematic symptoms for patients themselves, for their families, and for healthcare in general. And clearly, the resource use required to monitor and manage these symptoms are huge, particularly in the later stages of the disease, where these symptoms are most common and most severe, and particularly in people who are living in nursing homes, where this is a huge challenge for the staff there. Really, it's common. It can occur at night. We don't have that many tools to really help the patient. So I'm really pleased that this is a focus. So you mentioned the importance of assessment initially, right? So I think it's important to be very clear that although these are symptoms commonly occurring in people with brain diseases, neurodegenerative and other brain diseases and dementia, they can also be caused by other factors. So before we start thinking of this as a neurological symptom, we need to exclude other possible causes. That can be anything. It can be a physical disease. It can be starting of a new drug or stopping a drug. It can be also sometimes be changes in the environment. It can be malnutrition, etc. So there are a lot of factors which can lead to the symptoms. And for the clinician, then before any consideration of symptomatic drugs, for example, the clinician needs to really take a step back and really look at the whole context where these symptoms occur. Is there anything externally contributing or maintaining the symptoms? And then move into the more specific neurological diagnostics.
Yeah, sure. And talking about the some treatments, therapeutic treatments, I want to ask you also about recent news that recently came out. It was the approval from the FDA of this new drug, the brexpiprazole, that has been tested in Alzheimer's disease patients that we know is the most common neurodegenerative diseases, and that is the one where especially people in the nursing home are mostly affected by this devastating disease. Can you tell us some more about which kind of patients are the ones who can benefit from this new drug?
Yes, so that's exciting news. Of course, there are few studies in this space and even fewer with positive results. So that's very much welcome. I think we need to mention that the decision to approve has been debated. There are concerns that the benefit-harm balance. But I think in general, it's good that we have a drug that has shown efficacy for agitation in particular in people with AD. So that is a condition which is probably the most common and the most challenging, particularly again in the later stages, with verbal agitation or physical agitation, even aggression, which can be obviously a huge problem, and where we don't have very good tools. So this new antipsychotic is interesting, and it's good to see that there is a positive effect. So it's probably worth having on the list of things to try, drugs to try. Antipsychotics in general for these challenges is a hotly debated topic, has been for many, many, many years. And many will know there is a black box warning also in the US about using antipsychotics, including brexpiprazole. So in that sense, this new drug is not very much different from other antipsychotics, particularly the atypical antipsychotics. So it's good to have new drugs, but it's also important to strike a balance. It might be helpful and it can be considered as a drug of choice, but as with all these antipsychotics, it's important to monitor the patients very carefully, and if it doesn't work, stop, and if there are side effects, also reduce or stop, and always have a short-term therapy, even if it works, and it should not be something that the patient should take for many months. I think the limitation should be 8 to 12 weeks independent of the effect, and then try to taper down.
Yeah, but I agree with you. It's very important to have a new weapon in our arms because, as you said, agitation is one of the most difficult symptoms to manage with. And especially with sometimes we have bad effects, so we have to change drug. Of course, we have to monitor the side effects that sometimes can still make it much more difficult the everyday life of patient. So it's important. Of course, I think that all of us clinicians, we are very excited to try earliest as we can this new drug. And going back to what you said earlier about that the behavioral symptoms can be caused, of course, but there are many causes of behavioral symptoms, but how should neurologists or a psychiatric behave when he's got a patient coming in his outpatient clinic that is older than 50 years old and is complaining, he or his caregiver is complaining of as a first manifestation of a behavioral symptom, which is what the physician needs to do, which are the red flags that could lead us to specific diagnostic workout and also treatment.
Yes, it's interesting that you mentioned this, Francesco, that although we have been discussing agitation and other symptoms in the later stages of diseases, there has been a larger focus on behavioral and psychiatric symptoms in neurological diseases in the early stages, including the neurodegenerative diseases. I think that's really important also to focus on that. So I will assume that people come to neurologists, they will have some neurological symptoms, either movement disorder or cognitive symptoms, right? So they won't come to a neurologist if they have purely a psychiatric mental symptoms, I assume they will then go to a psychiatrist. But if depression or apathy or even hallucinations are occurring and it's being presented by the patient or by the carer, often these symptoms are easier to collect from a relative because the patient themselves might not be aware of it or might don't want to disclose the symptom. So it's important, first of all, it's important to really always explore the presence of these symptoms. So even if they are not presented spontaneously by the patient or the family member, the clinician need to consider them, also a neurologist. If a patient come in with movement disorders or with cognitive disorder, the neurologist always have to think and screen for are there mood symptoms or are there psychotic symptoms also. That's an easy thing to do, asking whether hallucinations occur or whether there are thought disorders or mood changes. So that's the first thing to consider that. And I'm really glad that you asked, Francesco, about this because my experience is that not every neurologist has this really high up on the agenda to consider this. And it's really important in order to identify disorders which are characterized by these symptoms. And you've mentioned dementia with Lewy bodies as one. And of course, frontotemporal dementia is another one. So for these disorders, psychiatric symptoms can be really the first one. But that's also true for Alzheimer's disease sometimes and also Parkinson's disease. So I think we are realizing now that all the neurodegenerative diseases, in some instances, the behavioral or psychological symptoms can be the initial symptom.
Yeah, because just, you know, the question I just made to you, it came out also from my clinical activity in which, you know, sometimes you have patients who have an anamnesis negative for psychiatric diseases. And so suddenly at around 55, 60 years old, they have these psychiatric symptoms. And this brings also to a delay of a proper diagnostic workout, because sometimes maybe they are managed just with antidepressant, antipsychotics, they are seen, in the context of a normal psychiatric syndrome, if exists a normal psychiatric syndrome, but maybe sometimes they should be, directed to a specific diagnostic workout, maybe more to a neurodegenerative diseases. In fact, for example, the recent criteria of the prodromal Lewy body dementia, which we know you've been, it's your main area of interest, and you've been author also of these new criteria, individuate some specific symptoms as onset. We have the delirium onset or the psychiatric onset. So I think, especially for DLB, these are very important features.
Yes, indeed. I think that's a good point. Now, these criteria, they are still research criteria, so they are not yet established, right? But they have been proposed and they are now being researched, because the evidence for these two, let's say, prodromal types is less clear than it is, for example, for the, let's say, the MCI type of the prodromal DLB. So more research is clearly needed. But I fully agree with you that we also need to remind our colleague psychiatrists that people above 50 years old with new onset psychiatric symptoms, they always have to keep in mind that this could be part of a neurological, a brain disease, right? So that I'd keep that in mind and check for, let's say, neurological symptoms and include imaging or even CSF or new blood markers as in the diagnostic workup to tap into this, because I completely agree with you that person with a neurodegenerative disease should not be taken into a standard psychiatric treatment regime only. We need to explore the whole pattern of the symptom and need to keep in mind that brain diseases can occur. But obviously, that can be a hard challenge to tease out. What is this a functional psychiatric disorder or a more organic neuropsychiatric? But that's an extremely interesting clinical situation, right?
Also, because sometimes when we see this kind of patient and we start with all the diagnostic workout, we found also some positive tests, like for example the PET FDG that is positive in some patients, so we think that maybe can be an early guaranteed disease. But then sometimes there are also some psychiatric patient, maybe a long diagnosed patient, maybe they can have some positive PET imaging. So, you know, it's never easy, let's say, to conclude a specific diagnosis. And this is, I think, even more interesting. I mean, if we want to divide, you know, I remember when I was studying in psychiatry, but also in neurology, the behavioral symptoms, there was this division between positive and negative behavioral symptoms. So, for example, for the positive symptoms, we know that there can be some confusion maybe in patients, as you mentioned earlier, between a prodromal Lewy body disease or, for example, a behavioral variant of frontotemporal dementia. So how can we, let's say, navigate through these two different diagnoses?
Yes, that's an interesting question, and it's also interesting because, as you know, the best diagnostic markers that we have now is the dopamine transporter SPECT, and in some cases we have, let's say, false positives in terms of having a DLB, and frontotemporal neurodegeneration can be one of the situations where we have an even have an abnormal DAT scan, but not in a DLB context. So that makes it even harder. But I think most patients with FTD and DLB are quite nicely separated. The typical psychological changes in FTD is more like disinhibition type and social changes and language changes, rather than visual hallucinations, which is a typical psychiatric phenomenon of DLB. So in that sense, I think that's at least the starting points where they tend to differ. But then we have symptoms like depression and even apathy, which can occur in both. Although I think apathy is particularly pronounced in some patients with FTD. So back to your comment about positive and negative symptoms, I think that's a helpful distinction kind of for us as clinicians. And the challenge is here to be aware of the so-called negative symptoms, because the positive symptoms are then usually observed or reported, like hallucinations, delusion, agitation, that you don't miss those symptoms, whereas the negative symptoms you sometimes miss because they're not creating any problems or issues to patients with apathy, right? They are not complaining themselves, and the healthcare staff tend maybe not to complain because the patient is just sitting there and not disturbing anyone. Very easy patient to have.
I think this is one of the hardest points, in fact, you know, also because apathy is one of the most common symptoms at the as onset of the Alzheimer's disease patient. So we see a lot of patients, as Alzheimer's disease is much more common than the other neurodegenerative disorders, we saw them a lot, and it's very difficult to investigate. And also, you know, as you just said brilliantly now, also from the carers, from their family, it's really hard to address this point that, you know, should raise some concerns in our...
Yes, I fully agree. And I think it's a family that is the target to address, because many patients with apathy are not aware of that and don't see it as a problem. Whereas as a family, particularly the partner, then is the person that has noticed that this previously very active and engaged, interested in many things patient now has changed, with much less motivation, no interest, and no drive to do stuff.
And talking about the lack of drive, the lack of motivation, what do you think it could be a proper therapeutical approach? Because also there are, you know, when we talk about motivation, interest, we know that dopamine is involved. So do you think that dopamine agonist treatment could be helpful in the management of this patient, taking in account also the possible rise of side effects, of course?
Yes. So that's a very important question. And it's a question that hasn't been really addressed with systematic studies. So I don't think there's any drug approved for the treatment of apathy in neurodegenerative disease, unfortunately. But there are a number of studies that suggest that dopaminergic agonist or even methylphenidate or other dopamine stimulants might be helpful. But that's other drugs that have been tested include the SSRIs and also cholinesterase inhibitors, which is all makes sense because it's not only a dopamine, but it's also acetylcholine and serotonin, and you know these neurotransmitters interact as well. So there are many, let's say, potential strategies that can be considered, but nothing approved. So nothing that can really be recommended as a treatment for apathy. So then it's back to the clinician to see. And if people have, let's say, if people have a condition where cholinesterase inhibitors are indicated, then definitely that should be the first step, right? If you have an Alzheimer's disease, and then this is clearly you start with a cholinesterase inhibitors. And if you think maybe there are mood symptoms, and the distinction between apathy and mood and depression is also extremely interesting and challenging, right? When is it apathy? When apathy with or without mood symptoms, right? But then if the clinician suspects mood symptoms, then that an SSRI can be tried that might also have a positive effect on the apathy. So those are, let's say, safer grounds. Dopamine agonist or even methylphenidate, that's then on a little bit more experimental basis, right? And
yeah, I think that, yeah, we need larger clinical trials investigating, because this is a very important aspect that, of course, needs much more attention as clinician, especially taking into account also the possible side effects. And instead, we talked also before the best maybe therapeutic option also for the positive symptoms for hallucination. And could you recommend, for the young neurologist, some specific guideline or some specific, advice from a therapeutic point of view?
Yes. So hallucinations, both occurring in Parkinson's or DLB, but also in Alzheimer's disease, it's important to say that you don't have to treat every hallucination, right? They don't necessarily represent a problem. And they can even be entertaining and a positive distraction for the patient. But sometimes it is a problem and you as a doctor want to help. And then for hallucination, I think we have some evidence that some drugs might work. And particularly in the Lewy body Parkinson spectrum, I think there is good evidence for clozapine. And I am a big fan of that drug, and I think it's underused, right?
It's clozapine is magic sometimes, The problem, at least in Italy, sorry if I interrupt you, that we need this very strict monitoring of the white blood count, especially for the neutrophils, that actually is quite of rare. We have a trend, maybe, but I just, in my clinical practice, I really rarely need to interrupt for a frank neutropenia, But I think that is a very great drug, clozapine.
I fully agree. So we are on the same line there, Francesco. That's good to see. So, and I agree with you. We have to do all this reporting, which I think is a little bit of an exaggeration, because as you say, it's extremely rare that we have really severe changes. But anyway, even without those challenges, I think it should be used more. The most used drug is quetiapine. And although there's no evidence whatsoever, I think, out there, which is robust. I think many clinicians, all the highly respected expert clinicians, use it and have good results with it. So that's clearly also an option. We also always need to think about dosing, effect, and tolerability, as we discussed earlier.
Indeed. Yeah. Also because clozapine, since it's got this specific anti-dopaminergic activities against the D4 subtype receptor, it's got a very low anti-Parkinsonian effect. So, and it's specific for sedation, while quetiapine is much more histaminergic. So maybe it's much better for sleeping than for treating.
Yes. And, in Alzheimer's disease, which the patients are somewhat less sensitive to antipsychotics, I think risperidone is also an acceptable alternative for hallucination. But I think important also to remind again that cholinesterase inhibitors, at least there are some indications that they might reduce or prevent occurrence of psychotic symptoms. So if the patient is not on cholinesterase inhibitor, then that should be the first choice. And then that might relieve them. You don't need antipsychotics. So.
Yeah, that's of course. But usually, this patient, they're already under cholinesterase inhibitors, and so this is our struggle. So I would have a lot of so many questions, but I think we are running out of time. But however, I think that we listed some important key points, not just for the diagnostic management, but especially for the therapeutic management of people with behavioral and psychiatric symptom in dementia. And we really hope that, of course, as you said, there are some criteria that are research, so we need much more research. We need clinical trials, to do large clinical trials. So this is a hope also that in Europe, and not just in Europe, there is a much more effort for this, and we need to collaborate and to put all our energy together to address this very important aspect, because as you said at the beginning, there is an important economic, socially, for the families, for the patient, but also for the families and the caregivers, and economical burden for the all the healthcare system. So I really want to thank you, Professor Doug Arsland, for this really nice chat that we had.
Thank you, Francesco. It's a pleasure.
And I want to thank also all the EIN staff for allowing this interview. And thank you all for the attention, and see you soon for the next episode.
This has been EIN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.